This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Today marks 1 year since a mass shooting left three people dead at Fountain Square in downtown Cincinnati.
People were running away from the square, and I peered around, and about 30 seconds later, I heard about 5 to 10 more gunshots.
That was witness Sam McDonald. What have we learned in the 12 months since about the killer, the community, and local gun violence? We start the Friday news review with local reporters who were among the first to rush to the scene on that tragic day 1 year ago. Joining Cincinnati Edition are Inquirer reporters Ann Saker. Welcome back, Ann.
Thank you.
And Cameron Knight. Welcome back, Cameron.
Thanks.
And we also have WVXU reporter and host of All Things Considered, Bill Reinhardt. Hi, Bill.
Good afternoon.
I believe we have some more sound from that day.
Well, about 9:19, we had customers in line. We heard a loud boom. We thought it was construction, but it wasn't. We heard a second and third boom, and we found out there was gunshots, so we all hit the floor. And we told the customers to come in there with us, which they did. And he kept shooting. Then he stopped to reload, reloaded again. We saw another customer, told him to come in there with us when he heard, saw the man start shooting again. And that's how he shot the glasses, made the glass shatter. We saw that from sitting on the floor. Started smelling the gunpowder. He was that close. Like, all he had to do was look over the counter and shoot, because we ain't got no glass to, like, shield us.
And that was Whitney Ebony Ginyard speaking that day. She was interviewed by Inquirer reporter Sharon Coolidge. We thank her for allowing us to use that sound. We also want to hear from you during our conversation today. What are your memories of that day? What did you see that day if you were in the vicinity of downtown when the shooting took place? Call us, 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll look for your comments and your tweets. So that was a very sad and chaotic day, and we're talking about it today in the context of being journalists and the type of work that we have to rush into doing when something like this breaks. Let's go back to that day. All of you are journalists who covered this tragedy and in some way or another. What are your recollections from a reporter's perspective about how that day played out? Cameron, we'll start with you.
Yeah, I mean, I listen to police scanners all day long as just part of my job. It's just always on in the background. And I heard some reports, and I started listening a little bit more intently. And then once you've listened to police scanners long enough, you can kind of get a sense for how actually real something is, how important something is. And when I heard an officer come over the radio and report that that shots were being fired, somebody was down, I jumped out of my seat and grabbed my stuff and took off to Fountain Square. Luckily, we're pretty close. I got there as quickly as I could. But by that point, what I was actually hearing on the scanner was the police shooting the suspect, Omar Santa Perez. That was the moment when I took off. So by that point, the shooter was already down, and the police were already on the scene. So by the time I actually got to Fountain Square, they had started to rope things off. At that point, I was just trying to talk to some people who were in the vicinity, and I was seeing the thing that sticks out to me a lot that day was seeing the Fifth Third security guards in their brown uniforms. You know, they have these very distinct brown uniforms, just hugging each other and like holding each other outside of the Fifth Third Center. And from there, it's a kind of a brave new world with how media works these days. So I immediately went on Facebook Live and started trying to report things as I saw them, and in the background checking Twitter feeds and everything else to try to see if other people were reporting things, the police department, anyone else was putting information out online so that I could keep the Facebook Live going. And I was live for, I think, an hour and a half or 2 hours straight on Facebook. And then from the rest of then, it was just trying to put the rest of the pieces together, which has continued up until now. I was writing stories up until now about the investigation, the progress it's made, that kind of thing.
Social media has really made our jobs easier and more difficult in a lot of ways, because on the one hand, you have this new way to reach an audience in an instant. On the other hand, that audience also has a way to reach one another in the same instant without following the traditional protocols that you or I would want to follow based on the ethical requirements of our industry. So yeah. Can you talk a little bit about how you navigated what you were doing live from the scene on social media independently while also trying to follow what regular citizens were putting out?
Yeah, so I was, and you know, I mean, a phone is almost like it's a command center. Like a journalist from 30 years ago would be just like shocked at the power. The interesting thing was I started seeing comments come up on the feed that, you know, this many people are dead or the shooter's dead and everything else. And I just tried to be as honest as possible with people and said, you know, we're seeing conflicting reports. At that time, we had two separate city council members tweeting out things or sending out information about different numbers of people. We had conflicting information even from city council members. So I was just upfront. I was like, we have conflicting information. I'm not going to report a number or a thing because I haven't heard it from the officials yet, but stay here with me and you can see them tell me exactly what I'm going to find out. So
513-419-7100 is the number to call to join our conversation. Bill, you were pretty quickly on the scene as well. Take us back to that day from your perspective.
I was sitting at home. I live downtown, and I was just kind of waiting to go to work, waiting for 10 o'clock to roll around. And a little after 9 o'clock, I heard sirens like I had not heard in a very long time. And I turned on my scanner, just the fire department channel, and just in time to hear the dispatcher say, active shooter, 5th Third Tower, Fountain Square. So I grabbed my gear, called the boss, called Marianne, let her know what was going on, because we don't have scanners here at WVXU on all the time. Let her know what was going on, and then as I'm riding down the elevator, I'm trying to tweet it, and of course that's when your fingers get really fat, and so it's backing up and correcting and trying to just get something out there. Hustle over to Fountain Square, or not to Fountain Square, but I first went to Walnut and 6th. That seemed to be where a lot of the activity, police activity was, and ran into you, Cameron, right about there. Police vehicles, fire trucks were still coming to the scene at that point, weren't getting any information. I was able to get an officer to say that the media staging area was going to be over at 5th and Vine, so I walked over that way and really couldn't see anything. For a bit, they were putting up the tape at that point. Talked to Mr. McDonald, who we heard at the beginning of the show, where he said he was walking into work, had his earbuds on, and suddenly he sees people running towards him. He pulls out the earbud, and someone says, don't go that way. There's someone shooting. So just about that time, he heard a lot more gunfire. So did a quick interview with him, sent that back here to the station. Stuck around there at 5th and Vine for a couple of minutes, just long enough to see two ambulances leave the scene with a police escort, and realized that we weren't going to get – I was the only media person at that corner. So I thought, you know what? Experience has told me, find other reporters and gather with them. If you want the police or the fire department to come talk to you, you got to be in a cluster. So I walked around over to Walnut and 5th. And that's where all the other reporters were starting to gather, behind the yellow tape. And we just sat and waited for a good long time, watching, waiting, trading rumors that we had heard, but just saying, oh, I've heard this and I heard that. And, well, have you got any confirmation? Nope, got nothing. Spent a lot of time also responding to social media, Twitter. It was kind of amusing. A number of TV stations from across the country are like, hey, great pictures. Can we use those? No, you cannot. Thank you for asking, though.
How do you make that decision, if I may ask?
Well, we are a news organization, and we share it with other public radio, public media outlets. And, these other TV stations, they've got local outlets here, so get your stuff from them, you know?
Ann Saker is also with the Cincinnati Inquirer. We've heard from Cameron and Bill about sort of the chaos of the scene, but newsrooms with multiple reporters are always looking for multiple angles to approach a story. You mostly focus on health-oriented reporting. Can you talk about how you became involved in the storytelling process about this event?
Absolutely. Thank you so much. I was about three steps behind Cameron to the square. I also saw the ambulances. I saw them load the injured into the ambulances to drive off to UC Medical Center. And we know, I think all of us who've been covering this understand that the phenomenon of a mass shooting is not just a crime, but it's a social ripple that flows through the entire city. Although I got to tell you, I was surprised that the next day, Friday afternoon, after we had been running and gunning for two days, when I finally got home late that Friday night, I talked to a friend of mine who works at a news organization in Washington, D.C., and she told me about all her week, and she said, what happened in Cincinnati? And I said, we had a mass shooting here. And she said, what? So the ripple of our news did not get to Washington, D.C. by Friday. Because we are having these happen over and over again. To me, what is intriguing is the slow awakening and understanding that there is a profound connection between these events and the large umbrella term we call mental illness. When the FBI did a study of these events in 2014, what they came to understand is that within the year before of a mass shooting, half of shooters had expressed some suicidal ideation to someone at some point. So it's not really – it's unfair to call this an issue of mental health exclusively. First of all, it's unfair to people who do suffer with mental illness because they are much more likely to be victims of crimes than to perpetrate crimes. But what this is, in fact, is a metastasis of the suicide epidemic. I did a story shortly after the shooting last year talking to a lot of experts who are saying what we are seeing here is suicidality merging with a deep, profound rage. I'm not just going to kill myself. I'm going to take out a lot of people with me. That it's being expressed as a complication and intensification of the suicide epidemic that we've been experiencing in this country for 20 years. So unless we want to address that particular component of it, and some organizations are. I did a story after the shooting about the Buckeye Firearms Association working with several suicide prevention groups in Ohio to reach gun owners and gun stores to get the suicide prevention message out there, because where guns are concerned, there are far more suicides than there are homicides. And mass shootings are an even smaller class of homicides. So if we could address the epidemic of despair in this country, we might be able to get our arms around the phenomenon of mass shootings.
You raise an interesting point about talking to your friend in Washington, D.C., who's in the news business but wasn't even aware the next day of what had happened in Cincinnati. And on yesterday's show, I had the opportunity to interview Whitney Austin, who was from Louisville, but works for Fifth Third and was coming into work at Fountain Square that day and was shot 12 times and somehow managed to survive. She came on the show yesterday. And one thing that she has done is created this organization that will be advocating for what she calls responsible gun ownership. I wanted to ask her about how she keeps heart with that effort and trying to change hearts and minds to see some type of reform that would be pleasing to her and people who have experienced what she's experienced. And I wanted to ask her that in the context of what had happened leading up to the Cincinnati shooting in terms of mass shootings across the country and also after relative close calendar proximity. And as I was going through the national list, I wasn't including some of the ones that had four or five fatalities. I was looking for the ones that had 11 or 12, and of course, there were plenty of those as well. But it's strange how this has impacted our perspective on mass shootings now, because they do happen so frequently, and the body count can play a role in how long it stays in the news cycle and what people know about it. And to that end, the Inquirer put out an editorial this week coming up to the one-year anniversary. I want to read part of it. This is from the Inquirer editorial board. Quote, by the following Monday, Fountain Square was mostly back to normal. People were eating outside, walking to and from work, meeting and greeting friends. And here we are, a year later. Food trucks have been out on Fountain Square all week as usual. There was salsa on the square last night. The Flex crew performs there tonight. Meanwhile, there have been more than 380 mass shootings in the United States since the Fountain Square shooting. Attacks over the past 12 months have taken place in bar districts, stores, schools, places of worship, bowling alleys, homes, parks, and public spaces. It has prompted a slew of rhetoric and sympathy from politicians, but minimal action. Cameron, can you talk a little bit about people's reaction in the aftermath of the local shooting as it relates to calls for change?
Well, the interesting thing that I found was that there really wasn't a lot of action that took place afterward. What I found more dramatic was what happened, kind of comparing what happened here to what happened in Dayton. I mean, within seemingly hours of this shooting in Dayton, and I think that this plays into what you mentioned about body count. Within hours of what happened in Dayton, we had the governor calling for his 17-point plan. I think it's 17 points. I forget. You know, which features red flag laws, which features stiffer penalties for gun crime and those kind of things. And I mean, I think there's a ripeness issue. Dayton also happened directly after El Paso. It was like two back-to-back high body count kind of situations. And honestly, the thing that I actually talked to Chief Isaac, Chief Elliot Isaac at the Cincinnati Police Department is, in Cincinnati, we have a gun violence problem anyway. Like without mass shootings, without Cameo, without Fountain Square, you know, there are 300 to 400 people shot in Cincinnati every single year. And so I think that because Cincinnati didn't garner national attention, there probably wasn't as much need to push on that front. And the kind of the more quiet, persistent efforts of pushing on gun violence in the city were maybe more of what was continued concentration on that happened versus any kind of large scale reform. So yeah, it was complicated, and there wasn't anything to really hang our hats on with this shooting either. In Dayton, it was the AR-15. In El Paso, it was, you know, Walmart and it being, you know, back to school day. In here, it was the Fifth Third Center, which, you know, there's a bunch of businesses, a bunch of different things. It was a guy with a handgun, not a rifle. He, you know, his background was a little bit uncertain. It was just more complicated situation with fewer casualties.
To your point, Ambriel Crutchfield, one of our reporters here at WVXU, reported in some of our coverage of the one-year anniversary. Cincinnati Police Department data shows there have been 240 shootings so far this year compared to 224 total shootings at this time last year. 21 in the West End, 21 in Over the Rhine, 20 in Avondale. Those have had the highest number of shootings in terms of neighborhoods. 513-419-7100 is the number to call to join our conversation. Steve is on the line. Hi, Steve. What's your question or comment? Hi, Steve. Are you there?
Yes.
Go ahead with your question or comment for us.
Well, I have a comment and a question. I remember President Trump saying, you know, I could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody, and I wouldn't lose any voters. It seems like gun culture is a big thing, and it has been a big thing for a long time, and it's always pushed off to mental illness. But we never seem to have that same argument about weapons of mass destruction. I consider these guns like AR-15, assault rifles, and weapons of mass murder. When people argue about Iran, they never say, "Well, Iran shouldn't have Iran is not mentally ill, so they can't." They cannot have a nuclear bomb, but that same argument never seems to Well, people say that Iran cannot have a nuclear weapon because, you know, they would blow up the world. But that argument, if you understand what I'm saying, never transfers over to weapons of mass murder when it comes to assault rifles. Does that make sense? My question is, why is it if it's good for the goose, why is it good for the gander? If we can say Iran shouldn't have nuclear weapons because, you know, they're mentally unstable, why can't we say that people in this country can have weapons of mass murder because people, anybody can go, Trump said, can go out on Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody.
Steve, we appreciate the call very much. Thanks so much for calling. I want to note that Mayor John Cranley here in Cincinnati wrote an editorial about the one-year anniversary. It's published at WVXU.org. I'll read a little piece of that now. Quote, "I will never walk on Fountain Square and not think of that day, but I will never forget the heroism, humanity, and altruism shown by Cincinnati in the face of pure evil. It is easy to get engulfed in the evil in the world, but it is important to point to the good. The good is our cops, firefighters, and 911 dispatchers who saved lives that day. The rest is at WVXU.org. That is an op-ed from Cincinnati Mayor John Cranley. And we still don't know a whole lot from the investigation from that day a year
ago. We don't. One thing we do know is that Oscar Santa Perez came wrapped in red flags. Long before he moved to Ohio, there were several attempts by his family to get him hospitalized because they were concerned about his welfare. He was threatening them. We've reported this many times. I also think a component of the response to the shooting is that he was, I think Cincinnatians would perceive him as outsider. He didn't live here for long. He was separated from the community. We don't know much about him. I think if the shooter had been someone who had been born and reared on the west side of Cincinnati, there may have been a different response to it.
It's interesting how all the different components from a mass shooting story can determine how we as journalists or we as the community may end up feeling about it in the long run. From the Cincinnati Inquirer, Ann Saker and Cameron Knight, I do appreciate both of you for coming in and chatting with us about it. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bill is going to stick around. We'll be joined by another Cincinnati Inquirer reporter, Sharon Coolidge, next. Our conversation will shift to a contentious meeting this week over the future of the proposed music venue at the Banks. A little later, the next installment in a series on human trafficking in Portsmouth and what health officials are saying about a possible connection between lung diseases and vaping. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. City leaders, developers, and business people were all part of a long and sometimes contentious meeting related to the future of a concrete plant and the proposed music venue at the Banks. Let's talk about what happened. The Friday News Review continues now with Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Sharon Coolidge, who joins us on the phone. Hi, Sherry. I apologize. That was my mistake. Hi, Sherry. How are you?
I'm good.
I'm glad you could join us today. And we still have Bill Reinhardt here, WVXU reporter and host of All Things Considered. Thanks for sticking around with us.
No problem.
513-419-7100 is the number to call. Sherry, before the meeting took place this week, where we saw some relatively heated remarks from the mayor towards some of the other people involved in this proposal as it relates to a concrete plant and the music venue, the business owners at the Banks came together to say something. What did they say?
You know, they really want, everything is a domino effect from the idea that there's going to be a music venue at the Banks. It's a very complicated process to get it there, but it is the underlying premise, a music venue at the Banks. And that was originally greeted, you know, with tales of, yay, we're doing this. And these owners, they want it because they know it's going to bring people and people are going to eat at their restaurants.
When the news release was put out about this announcement that was coming from tenants at the bank, the Banks, it seemed somewhat vague because I thought it could be interpreted that maybe some of the apartment residents were joining together to say, no, we want this music venue. Have we heard from the new residents of that area of downtown and how they might feel about the music venue coming?
I honestly, we never hear from the tenants. Sometimes I wonder if they're all tenants. You know, like, they're really nice when you walk down there and you just don't see a lot of people and you're like, where are the tenants? Like, I don't know. They never really come out and say things. And I don't think that this venue really is close enough to bother them because it's very close to the Bengal Stadium.
I gotcha. Okay. So, Bill, there was this meeting. Can you tell us who the players were at this meeting and where it was?
Tuesday night, City Council Committee meeting at Price Hill Recreation Center. You had the mayor, you had Amy Murray, you had Christopher Smitherman, Jeff Pastor, and David Mann, and then the county commissioners, Hamilton County commissioners, were all invited too. Only Denise Treehouse, the board president, was able to attend. And this was, you know, they wanted county and city there because the Banks is a joint venture between the city and the county. And we also had the county's counsel for the Banks, that's Tom Gableman, He brought along the VP from Hilltop Basic Resources, and there were some other business owners and a lot of Price Hill people, lower Price Hill neighbors, all involved. A lot of people not too happy about this deal. A lot of them think it's already a done deal, and they're not going to have a say in it.
And part of the deal is that this concrete plant known as Hilltop would have to find a new home somewhere?
Yes. It's a very complicated, a lot of moving parts in this. In order to get the music venue approved, you have to have the blessing of the Bengals, because they've got it in their contract that anything that's built in the Banks, they've got some say in. And in order to get their approval, you got to give them something. Since they're losing, they would be losing some parking spaces at where the music venue would be built, spaces used often for tailgating. The plan was, well, we'll give you some parking spaces elsewhere. And to the southwest of Paul Brown Stadium is Hilltop Basic Resources. So the idea is, well, we'll turn that into parking. And there's a lot of other details in that. But basically, idea is to move Hilltop Basic Resources out to Queensgate. Now, they found a couple of different spots that just didn't really work. But right there where the Mill Creek meets the Ohio River, there's a couple of acres on each side. And the idea is Hilltop would buy the west side and then trade it for the 2 acres on the east side. The 2 acres on the west side would be used to build a Price Landing Park for the city. And then the east side of the Mill Creek would be used for loading and offloading material to build to make concrete.
And Sherry, the meeting got a little testy, it sounded. Now, I wasn't there personally, but I was following all of you on Twitter while this was going on. It was really riveting tweets, and the mayor seemed particularly upset. What upset the mayor?
You know, he was very upset, and he was very mayorly. And he has been asking for answers about the cost of things and really these detailed parts of the plan. Where is the asphalt plant going exactly to move to? You know, who's going to pay to build this park? What's this park going to look like? There's a lot of questions that are still unanswered. And, you know, I have to agree with him. He had the chance to ask a lot of questions to, you know, the county attorney, who for all intents and purposes is the developer of the Banks. And he just was not forthcoming with those answers. And the mayor was getting angrier and angrier. And that led to get testy's fine, I guess, is the description. It was quite an exchange. And, you know, it was aimed at getting answers, and we left with more questions than we came with.
So, Sherry, where does this leave the talks about this project as it relates to the conversations about between the city government and the county government?
Well, at this point, you know, all of these questions, I think we really hit the ground running with the idea this week that council is going to need the answers, because there was really a plan in place that they wanted to vote on this. They think that, you know, this entire plan is a good idea. You're seeing the majority of the council say that. But without these details, council is putting the brakes on it a little bit. But the mayor, to be sure, is said that he is not going to forward legislation to them until we have these details. And that led to more testy exchanges in city council on Thursday.
Yeah, that's what I'm curious about. The headline in your story that you co-wrote with Scott Wortman at the Inquirer, Banks Music Venue Hearing Leads to Showdown Between Cranley and County. So the showdown.
I think it really did, though, this week, put the brakes a little bit on the project, waiting for these answers, where it was starting to seem like a rubber stamp and this was going to happen, and then we were going to hear the details. Everyone is like, slow down. You know, these residents were passionate. One woman was almost crying. They were angry. You know, I haven't seen a group of residents like this since the West End Community Council for the stadium. And this one was unexpected, because we did see the community council presidents, you know, in the area sent out a letter. And they said that they were for it and they see the good in this. But the individual residents, they just really came out. And it didn't seem like a coordinated effort, which sometimes happens at hearings and meetings. It just seemed like people wanted their voices to be heard. And I think they were.
And Bill, what happens next here?
Good question. The construction is proceeding with the music venue site. You know, the deal is not done, but they're digging holes. And it's gone beyond the point of just, you know, testing to see if the ground can support a structure. They are progressing with the construction. So it's going to be interesting to see how this gets pulled out.
I guess I have to ask, because we have this very strange Cincinnati-Newport rivalry that's burgeoning on the riverfront, where there are music venues and large Ferris wheels coming to both sides there. And so we heard the announcement this week that the County Commission gave the blessing for the Sky Wheel.
Sky Stars
in Cincinnati, Sky Wheels in Newport. So the Sky Star in Cincinnati has the blessing to have be a permanent fixture, which would bring in a larger piece, a larger Ferris wheel to be used and to become a permanent structure. And Newport still has theirs way out on the river somewhere. It's going to be shipped up. But Newport is already far ahead on construction of their music venue, and all the pieces are in place for there. But Cincinnati still seems to have to work out some details.
Yeah, Cincinnati needs to get an aquarium at this point down at the banks.
And then we'll start giving people a quiz, you know, which side is the Sky Star, which is the Sky Wheel.
You got to love living in a region
this
that has...
It seems like we're talking about a music venue, but this is the biggest project we have seen. It's almost, to me, larger than the soccer stadium, because the soccer stadium, with all of the things that went along with it, is going in the West End. But right now we're talking about, you know, really one of the last developable pieces of the riverfront. And the question at hand, it started as we want a music venue, and the question has become, what do we want our riverfront to look like forever? I mean, they're talking about building a 2,000-space parking lot and giving the Bengals a promised number of surface lots, which isn't exactly the best urban planning, design scheme. And so we're talking about that. And I think we're really at a turning point here. And it's a much larger issue than just like, do we want a music venue, which sounds great.
Well, we'll look forward to talking to you more about what comes to the riverfront next. Sharon Coolidge from the Cincinnati Inquirer, thanks for jumping on the phone with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And Bill Reinhart from WVXU will be listening to you later this afternoon on All Things Considered. Thanks for spending the better part of more than half the show with us today.
Always a pleasure.
Appreciate it, Bill. Thanks so much. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Former Portsmouth City probation officials stand accused of misconduct in trafficking in underage girls. That's just one revelation that we see in part two of the Cincinnati Inquirer's look at human trafficking in the Ohio City. The Friday News Review continues now with more on this story from Inquirer reporter James Pilcher. Welcome back, James.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And we also have Inquirer photographer Liz Dufour. Welcome back, Liz.
Thank you.
513-419-7100 is the number to call if you'd like to ask questions during this segment. James, remind us why you're here, because you came in not too long ago when the first installment came out. So let's just refresh everyone's memory about what took you to Portsmouth.
Well, I'm going on almost 2 years now. Ago, we learned of there was a federal investigation into drug trafficking that basically also laid out the activities of a defense attorney and former city councilman there who was alleged to be trafficking in women and prostitution. And given the current climate, it just said, we got to go take a look at this. So we basically spent a year and a half finding out whether or not what was in those federal documents was true. And we got 10 different women to tell us, yes, they had worked for Moran. This man's name was Michael Moran, as a prostitute, had been sent all over the country, you know, given drugs, all of the rest of it. So that was part one. As part of that, there were other well-known men of power, influence in the city that were part of this. One was a financial advisor, and the other was now a retired judge. Since then, the family of the judge tried to take control of his life and basically laid out in medical documents that he had been a severe alcoholic for the last 5 years, including going to work drunk going to work as a judge drunk. That has opened an investigation by the Ohio Public Defender's Office into up to 2,700 of his former criminal cases. The insurance agent slash financial advisor has had his license pulled by the state for possible fraud. We know that there's an ongoing criminal investigation into Moran about these activities by even the state attorney general's office. So about 2 months ago, we were continuing to report on this because we were obviously wanting to hear all the women's stories that we could. Somebody came to me, one of our sources came to me and said, I got a woman that wants to tell her story. And so, okay, I started talking to her and she started to lay out how at an early age she had started to associate with who was then a sheriff's deputy dispatcher, whose brother ran the city's probation department. And that soon turned into naked pictures and turned into sex for money. And she had had a horrible childhood. And the guy said, well, I can get you a modeling contract up in Chicago. Well, as soon as she got off the bus, she was turned into a prostitute at the age of 15. So that we had already heard the Malone's names in our previous investigation as possibly being, you know, purveyors of paying for sex or trading sex for favors in the probation office. We'd heard those rumors, reported a little bit on it, but this just rose it up. So that led us to talk to two more women. And then we already had talked to Heather, who was featured in our first story. And she had told us a story about how Michael Moran had brought her to the probation office and she basically traded sexual favors for a lighter sentence on probation.
And Liz, when you all worked on this the first time around, did you know that this was going to end up being a multi-part story, or did this just develop?
I think that when we first started, we went into it with, you know, we're doing this one story. But it was clearly evident that there was so much more to tell. I mean, because every time we went out there, we heard from people. People would email us. And we just kept on hearing over and over again, there's more to it. You've only scratched the surface. More people are involved. There's more women. I think what made this one a little different, beyond the fact that they were underage now, because before we couldn't confirm they were underage, but now women are stepping forward and saying, see me, see my face, hear my name, mm-hmm. because I am somebody. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's so much stronger, because I think so many times people marginalize these women. And, I mean, they're afraid for their lives and their children's lives, many of them, which is why they don't step forward. But for these women who have, I mean, they're so brave to say, look, I am somebody and I did not deserve this.
And I would say that what also raises this one above, that made this one so much different, is we had people who were actively members of law enforcement. Either, you know, the one of the brothers, the Phil Malone, who actually was the one who put the girl on the bus. At the time, he worked for the sheriff's office. Well, he got fired from that job. Well, then his brother hired him as a probation officer for the city. So he was dealing with women accused of prostitution and drug charges and all of those things. He finally was fired from that job after he was accused of bringing three women back to his house to pay them for sex, and they were all on probation. So this shows how pervasive the possible corruption and how pervasive this attitude was among the people who were paid to look out for these women. So that's kind of why this one was like, okay, this makes a natural part two. There was some potential tie into the previous cast of characters. As a funny aside, the judge that I mentioned actually wrecked his car 2 days ago, driving up in Dayton. So
under the suspicion of being intoxicated?
No, he was never given a sobriety test by the local police, believe it or not.
Well, I want to know.
So, but yeah, this just never stops getting. Every time I turn around, there's something else.
I'm curious about how so much seeming corruption could be taking place in one community. And Portsmouth is much smaller than Cincinnati.
Yeah, but
and last time you guys went in, you know, you were a couple of big city reporters, you know, relatively big city reporters coming into this town and digging up dirt and reporting on it. What impact did that have on the community of Portsmouth, and how have they received you this time around, Liz?
Well, I think that the other people have done stories on Portsmouth, but they've come in and done a one-off. They've come in and they've left, and nothing's ever happened. So I think as the community, when we first got there, they said, okay, this is just going to be one more story, and then we're going to go on, and everyone's going to ignore us. And so when the first story came out, it was kind of like, they're not leaving.
Right. I was there. I was in Portsmouth the day that the story published. So, and we have since been back about 10 times. So we're not going anywhere. So we've clearly shown that. And I would agree with Liz. And, you know, I would say I don't know what Liz's experience has been, but we monitor the social media that comes out of the city. And you're right. It's not Cincinnati, but it's 35,000 people. Now, that's half the size it used to be, but it's still not, you know, a little suburb or just a little, you know, blip. But it is in one of the poorest areas of the state. But I would say that 90% of the people are saying thank you, that we've known about this year. Nobody will do anything about it. Quite frankly, the local media won't touch it. And so it took somebody from the outside to shine a light on it. There are those that say, hey, why don't you pay attention to your own backyard? This stuff happens everywhere, whatever. But, you know, and our goal, and I said this earlier, our goal here too is that the Jeffrey Epstein story is getting so much attention nationally. It's sex trafficking against underage girls. This guy was a billionaire with flying around with Clinton and Trump or whoever. Well, this happens to these poor women in a town like this. And if it can happen there, it can happen anywhere. So that's kind of why we're not giving up on this.
And it's a long profile. The first one was a long, in-depth profile. This one is also a long one, now available on the Inquirer's website, imagine in print at some point as
Sunday.
Well. Sunday's print edition as well. The photos are really beautiful as well. Liz, can you talk a little bit about telling this story visually?
Yeah, this one was a little bit different from the first one because in the first one, we only had one woman who was stepped forward, Heather, that we could show her face. So a lot of B-roll that really showed the community. This time we had more women who went on camera, and so it was a little bit different. But so this video, I think, in some ways is stronger because you really hear their voice. You see them. You see the tears, you know, and asking, you know, why didn't anybody care? Why was this allowed to go on? So I think in some sense this one is a little bit more powerful because you really – you get to know the women, and you see them as women, as young women. I mean, Linda Mills is 34 years old now. Kayla's 32. Mary Lawhon, who is in prison, obviously, well, she's not on video, but she says, it's not that I didn't do the crime, but no one ever tried to help me and accept that why I was doing what I was doing. Right. And I think that's a big thing, too.
There's a good quote. It didn't make the actual story, but there's a good quote by the attorney general who's really taken an interest in this topic, Dave Yost, who says that, you know, how can you say that a 14 or 15-year-old girl is doing this willingly? How can you say that, you know, she's not, you know, she's making up her own mind? And given the circumstances of someone like Linda Mills, who had been sexually and physically abused by her grandparents, her grandfather for years, it was her way out. So, you know, it's you got to look at both sides of it.
Trapped and Trafficked, Part 2 by James Pilcher and Liz Dufour of the Cincinnati Inquirer, online at the Inquirer's website now in print on Sunday. Excellent work. Thanks for coming
Thank
in
you.
And talking to us about it again.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Let's close out this week's Friday News Review with WVXU reporter Tana Weingartner. Thanks for coming in, Tana.
Thanks for having me.
All right, your story is about Ohio's investigation of more vaping-related illnesses. What do we know?
So about 2 weeks ago, they came out and said we've had 6 reports of possible severe pulmonary illness that may be connected to people that were using vape or vape products, e-cigarette products. And then less than 2 weeks later, just on Wednesday, I believe it was, they came out and said, well, now we're up to 11 reports of illness, and we've confirmed 3 that there is a connection between somebody who had this severe pulmonary illness that exhibited, you know, shortness of breath, all kinds of breathing problems, a few other distasteful sounding side effects, and they have said there appears to be a connection.
What is it about the product that is hurting people on the inside?
Well, they don't know because these are not – the CDC has opened an investigation. They've had something like more than 200 reports. They're investigating in 25 states. But in fact, a CDC spokesperson was just in Cincinnati. It happened to be that Interact for Health was having their Greater Cincinnati Tobacco Summit the same day that the health department came out with these new numbers. And they haven't really nailed it down to anything. He was being, I almost want to say he was being evasive, but I think he was just, you know, being very sticking to the facts. This is what we know. And frankly, we don't know a whole lot. There appears to be a connection, there's no proof of it yet.
Vaping is often talked about as an alternative to cigarettes. People who maybe want to quit smoking cigarettes because the harm that that can cause is pretty well scientifically documented. Sure. So turn to vaping. It's sort of the same motion. It's sort of the same sensation. And now we're seeing that that may not be the case then?
Well, and I think it sort of depends on how who you talk to and how it's being marketed, if you will, or not. If you already are a smoker, then there are studies. There was just a report in January in the Journal of the New England Journal of Medicine that said, yes, it might actually be sort of a cessation type product. But the problem is they're saying a lot of kids especially are picking it up. And so it's the new gateway to nicotine and you're getting it more directly. And it's not as metered. So, you know, for example, if you smoke a cigarette, you've done, you know, whatever, when it's out, it's done. The Juul cartridge, if you will, or, you know, whatever cartridge that you're getting this liquid nicotine product that becomes the vape, you know, you could just puff on that all day or for however many hours. And now you've taken in the same amount as if you smoked an entire pack of cigarettes, but you might have done it in 2 or 3 hours. That's a big concern health officials are seeing with kids.
So some are saying that, well, sure, this may be promoted as an alternative to cigarettes, people to wean themselves off of cigarettes. But on the other hand, for younger people, it seems to be the reverse, that they're starting with vaping and then they're finding cigarettes to be more appealing.
Or just getting that nicotine addiction that way.
What are the local health officials saying about any campaign to quell young people's interest in vaping? I know this has been a significant issue for a lot of local health departments.
Sure. Well, Interact for Health was having their Greater Cincinnati Tobacco Summit, like I was saying, and I do think they were sort of focused a little bit more on smoking because the highlights, if their study showed that Cincinnati is above the national average in terms of cigarette smoking. 34% of Greater Cincinnatians use some sort of tobacco product. So I think they're trying to sort of, you know, look at that. And also, you know, the flavored products, especially menthol. And how that's marketed to different segments of the population.
It's interesting that it's following the same path as cigarette regulations because not that long ago, it seems like there was a campaign to get rid of certain types of flavors of cigarettes. You can't find the old type of clove cigarettes anymore.
Well, and just this week, Michigan banned all flavoring.
Yeah, so, over the same concerns.
Mm-hmm, correct. So, and then another thing that's just happening is, you know, and the vaping advocates have said, well, it's not, you know, standard legal vaping. It's illegal THC products. And now just today, the Washington Post is out with a report that is pointing to there may have identified something in THC, you know, so like marijuana-linked vaping products that actually have a connection.
I heard that on Morning Edition this morning, some former reporting about it that seems to indicate some type of vitamin E is being inhaled.
That's what we're hearing.
And it's not good in that respect.
We should look into it some more.
We'll do a little investigating. In fact, we will have this segment on Monday right here on Cincinnati Edition. We'll be breaking down more about vaping and the health concerns around it. Tana Weingarter, thanks for coming in.
You're welcome.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstrow. You can find archives of our program online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks.